The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, bringing you another Saturday afternoon show live on this January 19th, 2013. All right, I'm checking to see if I'm making any sound. I guess I am. Doesn't sound loud enough. If anybody can't hear me, let me know. It looks like it's, you know, there it is. After a couple of shows on, there it goes, on the big, big story of Sandy Hook, I think it's big and important, a major government psyop, I'm returning to the topic of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. The overall theme of all my programs and my writing, too, is what the Jews are doing to the rest of us, especially the racially white people on this planet, sometimes called European, we're sometimes called Europeans, which we are, and how they are doing it. I started this topic on the Saturday program on November 3rd, asking the question, can we believe what is in the protocols, or can they be true? Then I took it up on the Heretics Hour, my Monday evening program on November 20th, asking if the French Jew, Adolf Cremieux, could be the author and going through the timeline. Then again on December 10th with the Damascus Affair and the Jewish power structure in France, including the Alliance Israelite Universelle, possibly the first openly Jewish international organization that in 1860 called on Jews everywhere in the world to see themselves as one nation. Today's program will focus on the differences between the various translations of the protocols, and see what light that might shed on their meaning and value for us now. It's because of these previous shows that I hear from different people on the subject. One of the more interesting and with the most to say is my guest today. And he's just now calling. I'm going to answer his call. And so hold off for a second. We'll pick this up. As soon as I do that, I got to get my Skype page up. All right. No. Oh, doesn't look like. Well, wait a minute. Okay. Answering. Well, it hasn't taken yet. All right, let me try again. All right. No, it's still ringing. What the heck? Now there's a new call. Okay, I'm trying. Here's a new one. There he is.
Hey, hi.
Hi there.
Can you hear me
hi,
all right?
Hi, Harlan. Yes, I hear you just fine. I don't know
terrific.
I must have been... too slow. I did something wrong with that answering it the first time, but you called again. So, all right. Now, here we are. Now, I was just going to mention you, Harlan. Mm-hmm. So let me get back to my trusty page. And I was saying that, you know, I heard from different people about the protocols. I went through the shows that I've already done on mm-hmm. it, and that you are the most interesting of the people that wrote to me about it. And so I'm very pleased to have you with me today, Harlan.
Perfect.
Shulka, right? Harlan Shulka.
Yeah, Shulke. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you pronounce it Shulke. I'm trying to pronounce German words with that E on the end as Shulka, but I never say it quite right. You know, it's somewhere between
just,
and E and something. Well, right. He is a student of the conspiratorial aspects of several world-changing events in modern history and invests his time in personal research on those events. That's what I wrote. Now, I'm going to let you correct me if you want to.
No, that sounds good. That sounds good.
All right. Well, okay. Well, so welcome, Harlan, and it's great that you're here. I'm very pleased to have you here. I'm going to let you kind of lead this, but you did put up a webpage with some comparisons for our readers to see, and you want to give that out right
yes,
now?
Yes, sure.
Okay. And I'll just tell them that for those who are by their computers, which they probably are if they're listening live, you can go to CarolynYeager.net, and the first blog item there is the announcement for this show, and I did post it there.
Oh, you put the URL in there. Okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah, put the URL there. But give it to him anyway.
Well, I can read it out if you like. Okay,
uh-huh.
So it's www.autarkynow, which is AUTARKYNOW, autarkynow.info/translation_comparisons.html.
Right, and if you can't remember that, and if you can just go to CarolynYeager.net, you'll see it there. You can click on it. And if you want to tell us a little, whatever you want to tell us about your background and how you got interested in these things and how long you've been studying global conspiracies, if I might say, or
sure. Well, I first got interested in this actually through 9/11. I guess it was back in 2005. I was in a Barnes & Noble bookstore looking for something by David Ray Griffin, because a friend of mine was had a lot of respect for David Ray Griffin as a writer on spiritual and philosophical topics. So I was browsing his, trying to see if I could find any such books in Barnes & Noble, and lo and behold, I laid my hand on his book about 9/11, A New Pearl Harbor. So I was quite surprised to see that this was the same David Ray Griffin. So I pulled the book off the shelf and started reading through it, and then immediately was fascinated by it, bought it, took it home, and read it from cover to cover. And that got me started on 9/11, looking into 9/11, and very quickly became convinced that it's not at all what it seemed to be. So that's a whole story unto itself. But
right.
It certainly awakened me to the idea that there's things going on in this world that we are not supposed to know about, because when you're faced with a deception of this magnitude, it implies that there's an organization behind this. This is not something pulled off by, say, a committee of lone nuts. we're often told that many things are done by a lone nut. But in this case, it would take a lot more than one lone nut to pull off 9/11, particularly the destruction of the World Trade Center, which defies physics, and at least from the perspective of how it's, the explanations that have been given to us. So that opened up a whole realm of study. I became very alarmed and concerned and started digging deeper and deeper into the questions around 9/11. And sooner or later, that led me to looking at the what's called the Holocaust and the events of World War II, because it became more and more clear to me that they were linked and connected.
I rather took that same route, because I started with the 9/11.
Oh, is that right?
Earlier,
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe 2004 even, I started. I don't know when people started coming out with this stuff. Well, this was, nothing was said about it right away. Not much.
Mm-hmm.
Some people
saw right away that it was
it was late in the latter part of 2004, because I connected with that election of that year, the election campaign. And then, it was after I spent a couple years, it seems like a couple years, maybe it was a year, just, focused on that and really getting into the internet more, which I hadn't used that much. And been reading all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I get that way. I get kind of obsessed with things. And then I was going on more and more, you know, different, oh, some forums or some whatever, you know, places where people are talking together. And then I got into the World War II and the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And then that, I kind of went in that direction. But, okay, continue.
Yeah. So, well, one of the, you know, pretty early on in this process, I learned about the Mossad. I'd never even heard of the Mossad before I started mm-hmm. looking into 9/11. But a certain, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with the 9/11 truth movement, but it has different camps and different.
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with it, although I quit looking at that stuff sometime, you know, once I really got into the Holocaust, mm-hmm. World War II and stuff. Because, and, you know, I just wasn't too interested in all these, arguments about, you know, were there planes or weren't there planes and this and that. And it got so involved, and that's what I think was kind of destroyed the movement. Or really, what destroyed that? Why that has not gone anywhere? I think is because of all the disinfo that's been put into it,
right?
And disinfo agents, and it's still going on the same way.
Yeah, and I think we also see that with the protocols,
right?
You know, anytime there's something that's to be covered up or the public's not supposed to know about it, but it comes out anyway, it seems like the next strategy is to dive in with all kinds of other information to confuse the picture and also to, you know, do everything possible to discredit those who may be on track of actually getting to the bottom of it.
Exactly.
So the thread through the Mossad, so then it became clear that there, so the next thing I learned about after that was the fact that there are all these dual citizens, Israeli dual citizens in the American government at very high levels.
Mm-hmm.
So on the day of 9/11, you know, most of the major positions in the federal government were held by Israeli dual citizens. And that came as kind of a shock. I had no idea about that either. And I learned that Israel has a special exemption from America's citizenship laws for any other nation in the world. If you can hold dual citizenship and be a, you know, you can be a citizen of America and any other country in the world, just about. But if you even vote in any other country, if you're as a dual citizen, it immediately terminates your American citizenship. So that's part of, the, I think, the, I don't know, some congressional act from 1947 or something.
47, huh?
I believe so. Yeah, I forget the name of it. I read about it. But there's a single exception has been made for Israel. So a person can be a citizen of Israel and America and actually even not only vote in both countries, but even hold office in both countries. So this is one unique exception that's been made for the state of Israel. So that raise my eyebrows, made me wonder what's going on with that, because that seems like a very bad idea, whether it's Israel or any other nation. I mean, how can people that are responsible for our country have, you know, mixed loyalties like that? Anyway, there was a Supreme Court decision, I believe, in the 1960s that created that exception based on
wow.
a particular case. So here we have entanglements between, or some kind of relationship, let's say, between the CIA and the Mossad, and we have all these Israeli dual citizens in the American government, and we have this event of 9/11, and in its wake, of course, America is going over and blowing up all these countries that are neighbors of Israel for no apparent good reason. False, you know, based on false accusations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, starting with Afghanistan, then Iraq. And it's been ongoing. So that, somewhere along the way, I came upon the Oded Yinon plan from the 1980s. You're probably familiar with that.
Repeat that.
The Oded Yinon plan, Odedyinon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Israeli plan. It's their plan for the Middle East.
Okay.
And it's, you know, you can find it on the internet and read it. It describes how Israel's plan is to basically undermine the governments of all the nations in their region. You know, they have this plan to take over that whole part of the world.
And it's on the internet.
Yes,
is it on the internet? Is somebody having, you know, spirited it away from them and posting it, or did they post it?
Well, it was a public document. It was published.
Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not anything secret. I mean, at the time, nobody else was paying any attention, apparently. Mm-hmm. Well, people still aren't, I guess, for the most part. But it describes their strategy for taking the neighboring countries, you know, undermining their natural historical roots, their national roots, and breaking them up into tribal, back to their kind of tribal origins to, you know, sort of disintegrate their national power. So you can see that that's been done. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, they're basically in ruins compared to how they were before 9/11. I mean, it's very sad to go. I mean, I remember when the Iraq War was going on, I found some YouTube videos about life in Iraq before it was destroyed. And it was a very happening country.
Right.
I mean, the leader, of course, has been demonized. There's always, you know, whether it's Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, whoever it is, you know, in the American media. The leader's always demonized and made it seem like he's terrorizing all his people. So the best thing we can go do is go over there and kill him, you know, right?
Right.
But you know, that's not the picture there. I mean, people were, it was a thriving country, just like Libya. Libya was a thriving country. And now it's been, you know, reduced to smoking ruins. Oh, yeah.
I know.
Oh, yeah, Libya. I mean, Libya they've been working for decades on their infrastructure. You know, they had dams, electrical systems, highways, bridges, all these things. And Gaddafi was the leader of their country. And the people, you know, he was their leader. There was this bond between the leader and the people. He was their natural leader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I forget how many tens of hundreds, I don't know, just incredible numbers of people were killed in these bombing raids. You know, just thousands and thousands of bombs were dropped.
You know, the damage.
On a tiny country.
Yeah, the damage that we do, that you're just mentioning two places there, Iraq and Libya, the damage that we do. What we leave these countries in this mess, and then we say, well, now they've got democracy and
but they don't. What they have is roving gangs in the streets.
Yeah, if people would look at all that, if the media spent time describing this stuff, then people would be informed, but they're not informed. And they're only propagandized, and so, you know, we go along ignorant, and there you go. We know who's in charge of the media, so I'm
probably
ahead of you there. But
the media, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So this picture starts to come together, where you can see that America has been turned into, I don't know what to call it, something like almost like a mercenary state, where we're just doing the bidding of this foreign country, this other power. But the strange thing about it is Israel is not like other foreign nations where all the people in the nation live within the territorial boundaries of that nation. The Jewish nation is spread over the entire planet and has been since going back thousands of years.
Exactly.
So that's where we get into this whole business about conspiracy, you know, what people call conspiracy. Or what people try to discredit, or people say, oh, there can't be a Judeo-global conspiracy. How could that possibly be? But, you know, that puts it in terminology that is in some ways, I think, kind of misleading, because what we're really talking about is Jewish nationalism. And Jewish nationalism is not like any other form of nationalism, because it's global in scope, and it always has been.
And well, that's it. Yeah, that's interesting, because I was just saying before you called in that, you know, in my program about on December 10th about the Damascus affair, that I talked a lot about the Alliance Israelite Universelle in France. And I got real interested in that, because that seems to me, you know, they came right out with openly calling on all Jews to see themselves everywhere in the world, to see themselves as one nation, and they would be the representative of the of the Jews of the world.
And was that? That was like in the
1860. Now that is not the first that was going on, but that was maybe the first. I can't be sure, but when they just came out so publicly with it, they were so confident of themselves by then.
Right.
And that was before, or that was, you know, who knows when the protocols were written, but that was, you know, a little 40 years before they're supposedly came into
when they
public knowledge.
Became publicly known. So this idea of the Jewish nation, that goes way back. The idea of the diaspora, you know, the Jews were scattered over the world in 70 AD when the Romans, you know, sacked the second temple at that point. But the fact was that they were already spread all over the world. They had centers, and they were merchants, and they had their enclaves in just about every country and every city of the world, even then. And the fact that they were driven out of Palestine for the most part in 70 AD, and then 2,000 years go by, and now we have the State of Israel back in that same region. I mean, what other people of the world can be scattered over the planet for 2,000 years and yet maintain a national identity? I mean, there's no other example of that mm-hmm. I can think of.
Okay,
it's because most people that are identified with their nation are identified through their territory, through their physical territory. But the Jewish people had no physical territory for almost 2,000 years.
Yeah, and their language. And, you know, the Jewish language wasn't really followed, whatever language they originated with, some kind of Hebrew, they think. But they had this Yiddish.
Well, some spoke Greek, some spoke Aramaic.
Yeah.
But the unity of the culture was what preserved their national identity.
The religious laws, the keeping kosher.
Right. So the thing I think people have to understand about Judaism that also makes it unique is that it's not just a religion. It's this inseparable combination of religion and nationality and race. Mm-hmm. And culture, too. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is this combination, this peculiar and unique combination of religion and nationality. And many Jewish writers write about this. I found an amazing essay on the World Zionist website by this fellow named Eliezer Schweid, who goes into great detail about this. And how Jewish nationalism is not like any other nationalism, and Jewish religion is not like any other religion, and how people in the West are not capable of comprehending it, because Jewish nationalism does not fit into the conceptual models of the West. You know, what people understand as nationality, it doesn't fit. And the same mm-hmm. thing with religion, because it's a combination of religion and nationalism in one. And it also has this aspect of racial identity, which a lot of people kind of poo-poo that, and they say, oh, well, you know, you look at the Jewish people, and there's a mixture of races. Well, that's true. I mean, there have been different racial groups have fed in to the, you know, the gene pool of the Jewish people. But nonetheless, the intent of Judaism, going back to Deuteronomy, is to maintain over the long term to create a distinct racial identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, the Jewish leaders have themselves, you know, said, you know, we are a race, or they intend to be a race. And it's because of the promises in Deuteronomy that, you know, the promise in Deuteronomy is that the world is going to be handed over to Jewish dominion. So when that day comes, you have to, you know, there has to be some way of knowing whether you're Jewish or not.
Well, one of these, one thing that people would say about this or ask you about was, when they always bring up, what about all these atheist Jews? So most Ashkenazi Jews are atheists. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, and the Jews running Israel are atheists.
That's true. No, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the communists and the Zionists, they're all mostly atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all about this world. It's like
Man,
they are their own god in a sense. It's messianism.
What's written in Deuteronomy affect these atheist Jews because if they don't see it as religion, they see it just as much as history.
And the God of Deuteronomy is not the Christian God. It's not the God that Jesus taught about,
no,
or the,
right.
the God that Christians worship. And that's another huge, big misunderstanding. I mean, the incorporation of the books of Moses into the Christian Bible is essentially like a poison pill, because it takes this demon God, and somehow, you know, we're supposed to try to reconcile that with this God of, you know, that Jesus taught about, which is
universal. Now, I'm kind of sorry I brought this up, because you know, not, we'll get calls in the second hour from people wanting to talk about Bible things. So
let's move on.
So we'll never get our real topic taken care of.
Right. Well, so the point of all this is the Jewish identity is not dependent on, you know, believing in God. It's not dependent even on the practice of Judaism as a religion. It's you know, it's based on something else. It's based on your identity as a Jew, which is essentially racial, but also national. It's a loyalty. I mean, some people describe it more as a tribal. It's like a tribal loyalty.
I think the religion just feeds into that. You know, the people who feel about it, it just feeds into those things more than standing by itself.
Right. Yeah. Well, if I don't know what you think of Harold Rosenthal, but he makes a very strong point about that, that they use the Jewish religion as a cover so that they can set themselves up all over the world and not be suspected of being anything other than a religion.
Yeah, well, you know,
What that's actually doing is masking their agenda of global or international nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, we're not supposed to know about.
Yeah, people like Rosenthal, I don't go along with any Jews talking about these things, because they're generally trying to point out that there's these bad Jews in league with all these bad Gentiles, you know, and which hurts the real Jews, the good Jews, and so on. They don't denounce their allegiance to Judaism, so I don't trust anything that they say, and I don't like to use it or go along with it. But you can.
Well, they, in spite of themselves, you can learn from what they say, especially when they talk to each other.
Yes.
And a lot of the Zionist writings, like this Eliezer Schwartz that I was telling you about, he has this essay about Jewish nationalism on the World Zionist website. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's intended for other Jews. It's not intended for outside consumption. But we can go there and we can read it and we can see what they say when they talk to each other.
Yeah.
And it's very clear there that they are, you know, there's this nationalistic thread that runs through Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Call it.
Yeah, because the Jews are proud. They will say, you know, I'm a proud Jew. I mean, what is that? But that's nationalism.
Yeah.
And I don't mind if they say that, but, you know, that reveals, you know, I'm a proud something too.
Yeah, well, everybody's entitled to have a national identity. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's, in this case, it tends to work to the detriment of other nations because it exists within their midst.
Well, sure, that's the difference. That's the difference, you know, that you hit on right before, you know, earlier, that, yeah, that they're all over, they're spread all over, and they don't want to leave. They want to have this state of their own, but they don't want to go there. They try to get a whole bunch of people that aren't real leaders, you know,
uh-huh.
Eastern Europeans, Russian Jews, and all these, you know, shuttle people to go there. And
mm-hmm.
They coerced them into going there so they have a population that they could tell what to do. But the leaders, mm-hmm. of course, are different. So the leaders are like the leaders all over the world. They've got their plan, but they don't want all the Jews to be there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the plan of Deuteronomy is to take over the whole planet. So you need
That's
outposts
right.
everywhere.
That's right.
But they did establish with Israel a land base. So they now again have a land base of operations, which is a big, big step.
True.
And it took them 2,000 years to put that together. I mean, the determination over such a long period that was behind that, you know, it's pretty, I mean, it's hard to imagine any other people being able to do that. I don't know. But
well,
again,
how did they do it? So how are we going to learn how?
Well, that's what we're talking about here. That's where the mm-hmm. protocols comes in, and that's where this whole notion of global conspiracy comes in. But I think it's better, more clearly identified as Jewish nationalism.
Okay.
And it's okay. The picture, though, is confused by the alliances that they make with Gentiles. So this is where the whole business about, where, you know, Gentile masonry, that's where that comes into the picture.
Right. Okay.
You know, they're always trying to, you know, hide what they're really doing, because until it reaches such power that, you know, it can't be stopped.
That's right. And that's
so it's kind of a stealth nationalism.
Okay.
An author, a Jewish author, Bernard Lazar, is very clear about all this. He was writing back in the 1800s, probably around the same time as the organization you were talking about. He may have even been associated with it. I'm not sure. But he's quite articulate about it. I can read just a little bit of something that he wrote. He says that in the midst of this is speaking of the 19th century, you know, the 1800s when all this, the 1800s was quite a...
It was.
All the things that happened during that period, particularly leading up to the end of the 1800s and then going into the 20th century, like everything just like completely, well, anyway, that's another thing. But anyway, he says, this is speaking in the 19th century, that in the midst of a disunited Gentile middle class, whose members are engaged in a perpetual struggle against one another, the Jews stand united as one. This is the secret of their success. Their solidarity is all the stronger in that it goes so far back. Its very existence is denied, and yet it is undeniable. The links in the chain have been forged in the course of ages until the flight of centuries has made man unconscious of their existence. It is worthwhile to see how this bond of union was formed and how it was perpetuated. And then he goes into this really interesting discussion, and I think this may have come up in the International Jew as well. They may even quote from this, I'm not sure. But he says that Jewish immigrants and colonists took up their residence in foreign countries, and wherever they made their home, they constituted a distinct society. Their community centered around their houses of prayer, which they built in every town where they formed a nucleus. Everywhere they possessed numerous important privileges, meaning they had political power. This diaspora was, these people, the diaspora, were invaluable allies of the Greeks. And he talks about the Greeks and this, and I'm going to skip over that. But anyway, the thing here, though, then he goes on to say that.
Yeah, the first part that you read, though, was really good.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
it says
really.
In almost every city, they constituted corporations at the head of which was an ethnarch or patriarch, who, with the assistance of a council of leaders and a special tribunal, exercised all the powers of civil authority and justice. So they even have their own kind of internal government.
Yeah, well, this is what the International Jew talks a lot about.
Right.
Especially in the part we're at now.
The synagogues were veritable small republics. They were, in addition, the centers of religious and public life. The Jews came together in their synagogues, not only to listen to the reading of the law, but also for the discussion of their private affairs and for the purpose of exchanging views upon the general course of events. All the synagogues were closely connected in a vast federation, which included within its scope the entire ancient world, progressing parallel with the expansion of the Macedonian power and Hellenistic civilization. They communicated with one another by messengers and kept one another in constant touch with events, the knowledge of which was likely to prove useful. In every city, the Jewish traveler could count upon the aid of the community when he arrived as an immigrant or as a settler. He was received as a brother, succored in his need, and assisted in his designs. He was permitted to take up his home wherever he desired, and he enjoyed the protection of the community, which put all his resources at his disposal. He did not come as a stranger, bound upon a difficult conquest, but as one well-equipped and with protectors, friends, and brothers by his side. Throughout Asia Minor, the archipelago, Cyrenaica, and Egypt, a Jew might travel in perfect security. Everywhere he was treated as a guest. Everywhere he proceeded, straight to the house of prayer, where he was sure to find a welcome.
You know what strikes me here, that's really amazing and it's true, and is that how they – they refrain from being critical of one another. They must, mm-hmm. because a lot of these Jews must have been pretty scummy, scuddy, you know.
Well, among themselves, they can be pretty critical.
Well, they appear to be when they're being, you know, intellectual about it, but they must mm-hmm. not, you know, they must not discriminate that much among their people, or at least they see, because, but it's this, they don't see them as individuals who, whether they, you might like them or not like them, they see them as part of their arsenal there of that they need for what their plan is. And mm-hmm. so they have that value no matter what else they don't have or, you know,
mm-hmm.
Even if they're criminals, they protect and they mm-hmm. defend
oh,
and
yeah.
they try to get all their criminal elements to be not have to go to jail or not have to be, you know, pay for their crimes or whatever. So it's just so different from the way we are probably, well, at least white people do, because we think mm-hmm. we need to make everybody act the way they're supposed to.
Well, yeah, right.
We're
land-based.
Yeah.
But the Jews are not land-based. They're based in concept.
You okay,
know,
good.
It's a nationalism whose territory is in the mind.
Okay.
You know, it's this other kind of loyalty that, you know, the rest of us have a really hard time comprehending.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so different and so unusual. And that's what gives it its stealth existence. People can't see it because they don't have a concept for it.
Well, right. That's right.
And that's very good.
That's what gives it its power. Yeah, and this is what we need to. This is, you know, a good way of putting what we need to do, what needs to be done, not just attacking and criticizing what the Jews are doing today or, you know, last week or whatever, but teaching people about this entire scope of what they're all about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how different it is, you know, this concept that they have, as you said.
Right. So, like in America, for example, I mean, we shouldn't allow Israeli dual citizens to be in our government. I mean, come on. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
how do they...
If somebody's going to be in the American government, they have to be loyal to America.
How do they make people accept that and make them, you know...
Well, see, that's where the religion of the Holocaust comes in.
Well, I know, but could, you know, I start to wonder if even that's enough. I mean, you know, what?
Well,
kind
I mean, that's that that's
their sport.
That's their, what's that?
What kind of trick do they? How do they fool people to think
well,
that
that's
somehow
their sword
they?
Their sword and shield is the,
okay.
you know, is the gas chamber story. You know, the Holocaust, all that business. That's their sword and shield. You know,
yeah,
and
you
and
think
also,
that's enough? Then that? Oh, you're going to say also? Okay, go on.
Oh, and well, and also the you know the whole business about accusations of anti-Semitism.
Well, that's it. They have made people, and I don't think only the Holocaust is responsible for that. They have made people believe that anti-Semitism is some uniquely terrible thing, worse than being against anybody else. You know, it's uniquely terrible. Of course, the Holocaust is supposed to be uniquely terrible, so
mm-hmm.
maybe they do go together.
Well, this anti-Semitism phrase is very sneaky because it implies that a person is making racist judgments against individuals, when really what the problem is with the institutions of Judaism. It's with their, you know, the collective ambitions and agenda. It doesn't have to do with individuals. It has to do with the larger body.
Yeah.
But this term, anti-Semitism, we don't have a term for criticizing, say, Israeli policy. So if somebody criticizes the national policy of Israel, they're accused of being anti-Semitic, which is a, you know, kind of a mind, I don't want to use foul
language. Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about.
Right. But, you know, this is certain... Or certain elements do this. Certain organizations that are given all this media attention and public, and they publish what they say, like the ADL and so on, that will come out every time anybody criticizes Israel and is not, you know, they will come out and call that anti-Semitic. And then it gets in the mass media.
Right.
And it gets talked about and discussed.
So the accusation of anti-Semitism is always connected to an attack on a person's character.
Well, right, yeah.
So there's no way to criticize the institutional policies of Judaism without having your character attacked.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tricky part about it. That's what's kind of so devious about it.
Okay,
it puts it all off limits.
Well, so I don't want to wait.
People are afraid to talk about it.
Well, I know they are. Yeah, I think most people, our listeners, know that. Now, I don't want to wait too long to get into the.
We can
the translation. So,
but I think this is a good perspective to take on it.
Oh, it is. It is. Yes.
Because again, what we're not talking about is some kind of mysterious, you know, global conspiracy or whatever. What we're talking about really is Jewish nationalism.
And how we see it operating right among us.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about the protocols is that people who take it seriously say, but we see all this happening. You know, we see that in a sense, it's not predicted, but they're doing what was said it was going to be done in there. And that's mm-hmm. good enough for them. But then there are the people that question, well, but we don't know who wrote it. We don't know where it was written. And we're not sure about what the meaning is and whether it makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, I tend to be with those who see the protocols as having very ancient origins. In other words, the protocols are the sort of the handshake to Deuteronomy.
In other
words, Jehovah, whoever Jehovah is, whoever the voice is in Deuteronomy, who says that all the people of the earth shall be afraid of thee, and that thou shalt consume all the people which the Lord thy God shall deliver thee. Thine eyes shall have no pity upon them, neither shalt thou serve their gods. You know, all that this voice in Deuteronomy. This voice also says, this day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall hear report of thee and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee. So there's this promise. It says, therefore keep covenant for 1,000 generations.
Right? Well, some people would say that was all written later. You know, well, I mean,
well, Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
Well, no, the books of Moses were written around 600 BC.
Yeah, but are you sure? I mean.
Oh yeah, there's no question about
it. But
that.
Not everybody takes them for actual fact, because.
Well, I mean, there's
not
a
much
lot
history
of
going
obfuscation
on
going on around Deuteronomy, just like there is around the protocols.
Okay. Well.
But I'm just telling you how I see it, which
yeah,
is
right.
the protocols. Okay, we see the promises in Deuteronomy. Okay, how are we going to do this? You know, how are we going to create this global dominion that's promised in Deuteronomy? And protocols is a handshake to that. It's a description of how it's being done. I mean, one is the fulfillment of the other. It's the map to the fulfillment of the promises.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're going to take over the whole world, this is the way to do it.
Well, of course, the whole world was much smaller, so it could be that in 600 BC, when they were using, if they were using words like the whole world, they meant a much smaller area, sphere.
But it's a long-term vision. It's a long-term vision.
And yeah, all right.
There's something that's not quite human about it. I mean, it goes beyond what we, you know, most people would be able to grasp in terms of concept.
That's another whole aspect
of this. And we get that, at least I get that same feeling from the protocols. So to lead into talking about these translation comparisons, when I found out about the protocols and looked at them, started to read them, immediately in my mind, the authenticity, there's no question about the authenticity. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, there's this dark character to the protocols,
mm-hmm.
and the feeling of authenticity and genuineness that struck me very
well.
Very
I had the same. I had the same experience when I started actually reading.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
and I was just. In fact, after I might have gotten to protocol 8 or 10 or something, Mm-hmm. And I was going right along thinking, man, this is fascinating stuff. And then all of a sudden, I just couldn't stand any more of it.
Yeah, I know.
And I said, I'm going to set it aside so I can read something else.
Yeah.
For a while, and I never did get back to it. And then just recently, when I started these shows, I finished it all. And
very dark.
Mm-hmm.
Very dark. So that was my experience. And then I started reading what other people are saying about the protocols. And people are saying, oh, it's this clumsy forgery. It's and then there's this whole business about, and then somebody else saying, oh, well, it goes back to, they claim it goes back to Solomon, and that, you know, that's ridiculous. That's silly. Like in, what's the fellow's name?
Yeah, Vincent Renoir.
Right at the beginning of his article, he has this thing about how, about Solomon, that he quotes a passage supposedly from the protocols about Solomon. And,
but it's not in the other translation.
But I did a text search on the entire protocols document. Solomon doesn't come up in it anywhere.
Well, you know, I didn't remember Solomon. Now let's explain to the listeners that after we decided to do this program, and I had heard, or I knew some sort of vaguely, that Vincent Renoir, the revisionist, Holocaust revisionist, who has been on my program about four or five mm-hmm. times, and I like him very, very much, and I have a highest opinion of him, but that he had written a refutation saying he didn't think that they were authentic. It's in French. It wasn't available in English. And just recently, you know, I think around the same time you and I mm-hmm. were emailing, this person, and I'm going to call him... where did I put his name? I don't know where I put his name. Hasso, something. He told me that he could, it came up. Yeah. And he said, what I like for him to translate it, for me. I said, oh yeah, you know, and it turns out this wonderful person, he lives in Europe. He can translate quite a few languages. So he's translating something else now. I think he's already sent it to me, something from German. And mm-hmm. so he did this translation, and then I told you about it, and now we've both mm-hmm. read it in English. But I finished it last night. I have to say that I'll just give my opinion right off the bat and then let you talk about it, because, I felt that his criticisms didn't impact me at all, really, because they're about that there's no detail, there's no names of people, there's no pointing out exactly when this happened, when that happened. You know, that's just not the type of thing it is. And I never expected that to be there. I don't really need that, so I wouldn't find fault with it for those reasons.
Yeah, it's more like a conceptual template. I mean, that's the peculiar thing about the protocols. It can be applied at any time, at any place. It's not about it does have some specific references, and we can see how it played out, say, in Russia, mm-hmm. you know, with the takeover of the uprising there in 1917, and then the Bolsheviks and all that. But nonetheless, it we can also see how it plays out even today in America.
That's right. Very much so. Very much so. And this is why why I like it is not because I wouldn't criticize it from the standpoint that Vincent did. Because I see it as, I see that we're in a war, as you have pointed out so well, and that we need weapons, that they have weapons, and we need some weapons of our own. And I think the protocols is one of the best weapons in our arsenal, although I know there are those, like, and we've also, you also brought up Hadding Scott. We might bring mm-hmm. him up more in the show. And Vincent, who both think mm-hmm. it's worthless and shouldn't be even looked at. But right. I think if people would get behind it, and there wouldn't be so much of this detraction about it,
right.
it could be our most an amazing weapon that we hold. And that I think, I'm sure you'd agree, that this is why they go against it so much, but at the same time, we
really
do have our own people who are turned off by it and don't like it.
But that's where the translations come in,
Okay, right.
Really, really makes a big difference which version you're looking at and which version is, you know, forms the basis of your opinion.
Okay, and so you were saying, as I, you know, that about that Solomon wasn't in there, and yet Vincent.
So in Vincent's critique, he's apparently referencing a version. Where does he describe it here? That's in from the International Journal of Secret Societies.
Yes.
So this is apparently some kind of a French version. I don't know what the origins of it are. But right at the top of his article, he quotes this passage from the protocols. It says, quote, "All these errors were created and engineered by our educational program according to the plan developed by our sages, headed by Solomon, for the peaceful conquest of the universe, for the benefit of our crown, the House of David." And mm-hmm. then he gives a reference with Roman numerals that I assumed was supposed to refer to a protocol number, but there's no passage like that. In this case, it would be Protocol 18. There's no passage any even remotely like that in Protocol 18. So I don't know what his Roman numeral references, how they correlate to the English translations of the protocols. I was going to try to pull in some of his other quotes to include
I couldn't find any of them. Yeah, well, I didn't do that myself. I just depended on what you had. But I did notice that some of the protocol numbers seem to correspond to my mind, because as he went, and I may have it marked here, I don't know. No, I guess it's on the other page. As he went on and criticized that, where am I? That after promising all this stuff, then they just didn't come up with anything. Well, the promises were on Protocol 3, or what he called the predictions, and then he went back to Protocol 1. To show that nothing was, you know, being answered, so I thought that was strange. No, I don't. That does not go over. That you can't do that. You have to follow along. You know, if you talk about something in Protocol 3, you're going to find it. You know, Protocol 4 or 5 or wherever. And so there's a lot of jumping around in comparing protocols. But I think but the page numbers, of course, we can't use because we don't have that book.
But even the protocol numbers don't correspond. I mean,
I did find
one of them, and it's the one at the top of the document that's online.
Yeah, I'm looking at that now.
The comparison's online.
Uh-huh.
So the first one is from Protocol 4, but he lists it as being Roman numeral 6.
Oh, which should be Protocol 6.
But it's not in Protocol 6. It's in Protocol 4.
Okay.
So why he has Roman numeral 6 on there, I don't know. But that's true of all of his quotes. If you go to the protocol number that's indicated by the Roman numerals, you won't find the quotes that he's provided. So,
okay, well, what do
know.
You think are – you want to start with some of the most important comparisons?
Yeah, sure.
As you see,
well, we could start with this first one. I think it's an interesting example.
Okay.
And I first pulled this one because it was brought up in the piece by John Daniel that you had linked from on one of your earlier shows,
mm-hmm.
because it has some information in it about Camus.
Right.
And some of those goings on. So it's a very detailed, it's actually a chapter from a book by John Daniel called Scarlet and the Beast, A History of the War Between English and French Masonry. So Daniel appears to be recognized as some sort of an authority on Masonry. And I tried to find out more about him, though, and there's absolutely no information about him. He's not even in Wikipedia. So I don't know who he is. But he's written this major work, and, you know, you can find it online, and there's a website to this work, as well as other things that he's apparently produced. But I've hit a complete wall, dead end, trying to find out anything about him, you know, who he actually is.
Well, that's what you find. That's what I got pretty discouraged and irritated in looking for information about, you know, these not the meaning of what's in it, but you know, where it came from, and all these people's names and so on, and nothing leads anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's really no answers to that at all, which would indicate, in many cases, to a fraud, because, you know, when the leads don't go anywhere, there's no real evidence for anything. People say that's what you find in fraudulent things. However, the meaning and the information that's in this are so powerful to me that I'm willing to keep looking at it and keep talking about it.
Yeah. Well, referring to the protocols.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah. Of course. Of course. But it's interesting. But Daniel's trying to make the case that the world conspiracy is actually a Gentile conspiracy, and that the protocols are trying to make it seem like it's a Jewish conspiracy when that's actually a Gentile conspiracy to make it look like a Jewish conspiracy.
So who would he then be implying is the originator of it?
I think he speculates about that somewhere.
Well, we've got 60 seconds for a break.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I forget exactly what he says about that, but it would be, you know, it would be from a Gentile source.
Okay, Gentile source, right. All right.
So this is a very peculiar theory. I've never seen anyone else put this forward, but he's very insistent about it, which I think is revealing of probably of his loyalties.
Okay, well, since we're about ready to go for our musical interlude,
okay,
which will be 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, let me just give out this information now, and then when we come back, we'll go right into the comparisons.
Great.
And you can call after we come back from the break at 1-830-443-4911 to ask a question of Mr. Schulke, or you can't
stay on the line.
Yeah, you have to stay on the line.
Okay.
Probably should. And you can also send in an email to carolyn@carolynyager.com. So we'll be right back in 5 minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. I'm Carolyn, and my guest today is Harlan Schultke, who is a student of the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and some other things. We're talking today mainly about comparing the different translations and how they affect the meaning and the value of the protocols. And Harlan, I'm going to let you really go, and I'm going to try to not be interrupt you or come up with anything so that we can get through all these comparisons and you can say what you want to say. But I want to first, we got an email from the translator of Vincent's critique of the protocols.
Oh.
And he says, and this is Hasso Kastra. That's the name he goes by. And he says that some of the protocols, which are what Vincent calls seance, you know, seance numbers.
Yeah.
We call them protocol numbers in the Roman numerals, correspond to Marsden's protocol numbers, but others don't. And he said he didn't find all the quotes. I guess he means himself. Anyway, that's a message from him.
Okay.
So we'll go on.
Nice of him to call in with that information. Mm-hmm. So I think for our purposes here, it's most profitable to focus on the English translations that we're most familiar with, and mm-hmm. there are essentially two with some variations. The one that Vincent's using is kind of a wild card, and it's hard to know much about that, and it doesn't correspond very well to the other two. So maybe we'll kind of leave that aside. But the two main translations that we have in the English language are first and primarily the one by Marsden.
Mm-hmm.
This
one. Victor Marsden, and that's the one
Victor Marsden.
I have. Yeah, that's the one that I have, the one I read.
Right, and that's the one I read too, and I think that's the one that's probably closest to the original in terms of the accuracy of the translation. And one of the reasons why I think that is because of Marsden's mastery of the English language. He had a vast vocabulary and a literary abilities in English, which allowed him or put him in a position to create a document that matched the sophistication of the language and the protocols, which I think is very, very critical. So I could just read just a little short bit about his story, which I think is very interesting, and it also speaks to his motivation in making this translation. It says that he had lived for many years in Russia and was married to a Russian woman. So he, was very familiar with Russian life and the Russian language. Among his other activities, he had been a correspondent for the Morning Post, which is a British newspaper, a position which he occupied when the revolution broke out in 1917. And his vivid descriptions of events in Russia will still be in the recollection of many of the readers of that journal. I'm just reading this from the preface to his translation. It says, naturally, he was singled out for anger of the Soviets. He was arrested and thrown in prison, expecting every day to have his name called out for execution, but he managed to escape somehow and return to England. When he recovered his health, one of the first things he undertook was this translation of the protocols. So his motivation, is rooted in his experience, firsthand experience, of the Bolshevik takeover of Russia. He was eminently qualified for the work, according to the preface. His intimate acquaintance with Russia, Russian life, and the Russian language on the one hand, and his mastery of the terse literary English style on the other, placed him in a position of advantage which few others could claim.
Well, now, I have to interrupt. This is the preface to the book. So, this is the preface to the book.
Mm-hmm.
So they're writing about him in as good a way as they can and, presenting him. But I came across something on the internet, which was an unfriendly, it's Necropole, necropole.info. And it's about cemetery sites and people who have died and so on, what they find out about them. And
mm-hmm.
they say that, little is known about him. And that his writings for the Morning Post have never been collected, according to this, nor has his obituary been examined in any scholarly way since 1934, I guess, when this book was published. And then they kind of put down the Patriotic Publishing Company, with which published his translation, which was discovered to be only a post office box in Chicago. And they didn't really have a building or a business.
Well, it was originally published in England. I mean, he was British.
Yeah, he's British. So it was first published. They're just trying to. It was first published in England. That's the one that's in the British Museum.
Yeah, it's from the copy of the Nullis's. Yeah.
Okay.
That was in the British Museum.
Okay,
this might be another effort to discredit him. His translation is powerful.
Yeah, right.
And it reveals, at least in my reading, it reveals the true essence of the protocols, unlike any of these other versions. So it would make sense that, you know, there would be an effort made to discredit him.
Well, I have a whole lot of information here written about Boris Brazel, but that comes definitely... Semite paper or journal for against you know journal of anti-Semitism.
Oh, you found that? Yeah, I found that.
It was really a hit job. So you know, but you can get a little bit of information from it, but there's not much you can find on Marsden. And I even tried to. All I found was one little tiny photograph of him, which was not very flattering. He had big ears and it looked like it was when he was young. Now, why don't they have more about him?
I don't know. But from reading his translation, you can tell that his mastery of English was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the Brazel translation, which seems very crude by comparison.
And Brazel was a Russian-born, man, and he didn't come into the United. Didn't.
Right, he was right. English is not his native language.
No, and he didn't probably. I don't know if he learned it when he was in Russia, but he didn't come to the U.S. Mm-hmm. until 1916.
Right, and according to this article that you were just referring to, the actual translation that's credited to him was probably done by Natalie de Bogery.
Right.
Who was also Russian, daughter of a Russian revolution. What does it say?
Yeah, she's daughter of, I got some notes here, of a Russian officer, a nobleman, who was joined the revolutionary Narodnik movement, which was monarchist, and then he fled, and she grew up in this milieu of anti-Tsar. Oh, he was anti-Tsarist. Oh, I see. He wasn't pro-Tsarist. Oh, it was the other guy, Boris Brazel, who was the monarchist, but not de Bogery's father, obviously. And then she went to the United States. That's maybe why she married a Jew, and then she divorced him. And US, she worked for a crime.
And then they met up somehow.
Yeah, and he said, and he is according to this, he said in he gave a statement to J. Edgar Hoover that that she wrote it, that she gave it to him. He didn't write it. Translate it. He didn't translate it. He said the document was translated A to Z by a woman, Miss Natalie de Bogery. This translation, he said it was circulated among intelligence officers in the United States. One copy was submitted to the chief of war trade intelligence in Washington. And he transmitted this copy, this war trade guy, transmitted this copy to the chief of the New York Office of War Trade Intelligence, Paul Fuller Jr., where he, Brazel, was working. And he called me in and told me that he got it, wanted me to check the correctness of the translation. So I got hold of Ms. de Bogery, and she submitted to me the Russian text of the copy, and I went over the text and found it substantially correct. That was his statement to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He seems like a decent guy. The Jews want to tear into him, but, only because he's an anti-Semite.
Well, you know, he also was something like an attorney in Russia, and he worked on one of the blood libel cases.
That's right.
In Russia
maybe
before he came
to America.
We'll
have to do that another day.
Right. So obviously you're not going to like him for doing
that. So that's right. But his English would not have been as good as...
Right. That's the main point. Whether it was him or her, either way, in both cases, their mastery of English is no comparison to Marsden, whatever Marsden's story may be. But if we look at this first example of just how, you know, the difference in translation can take people in very different directions. Marsden says, who or what is in a position to overthrow an invisible force? And this is precisely what our force is. Gentile masonry blindly serves as a screen for us and our objects. The plan of action of our force, even its very abiding place, remains for the whole people an unknown mystery. So the first important thing here is that he makes it clear that Gentile masonry is in an antagonistic relationship to us. It says Gentile masonry blindly serves as a screen for us and our objects. So us would be the those who are, you know, part of the group that are, you know, represented by the protocols. In the other two, in all the other translations, that distinction is not clear. So in Bracewell's version, it says external masonry acts as a screen for it and its aims. So and then in Daniel's version, see, one of the things about the Bracewell version is the Bracewell version, but then there's also modified versions of the Bracewell version. So we have, you know, there's some kind of lineage to these versions. It's really, really hard.
So other people quote them and make changes. Other people take Bracewell's book and, or, you know, his translation, and then when they quote it, they make changes.
They modify it. And then that's what Cameron did, you know, mm-hmm. who was working for Henry Ford on the International Jew. He was, I guess, the editor of that. So he took it upon himself to, you know, modernize, quote, quote.
Right. But I don't see that it changes the meaning at all. It's just that some people think they can come up with words that are more clearly
sometimes
express something.
I mean, it certainly changes
than somebody else.
Yeah. Well, we could see that really clearly in the next.
Well, I mean, I think that John Daniel's version of what Bracewell translated is not so different, but Bracewell is quite a bit different from Marsden.
Mm-hmm.
These were two separate translations, not people knowing what the other person was writing, and just translating it as they thought it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So when you read Marsden's version, at least when I read Marsden's version, it has a completely different sort of aura or feeling about it. I mean, to talk about an invisible force is not the same as talking about a government. You know, we're talking about something else here. Mm-hmm. And this is a force that is moving through Talmudic Judaism over the centuries. You know, it's what gives it this ability to seek dominance wherever it finds root. You know, we're not talking about something specific here. We're talking about something almost occult or metaphysical.
Yeah, which is can be a reason why it's not written with all the facts and that Vincent wanted it to have, like who did this and who's speaking and who are they speaking about, and what, you know, they don't want you to know that. It's something else, like you say.
Well, it's not written for us anyway.
Right.
We're not supposed to know any of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not written for Gentile eyes, obviously. And then he says, the plan of action of our force, even its very abiding place, remains for the whole people an unknown mystery. I mean, just listen to that language. You know, it's very abiding place. You know, that's very different. It's a much bigger constellation of meaning associated with abiding place than in the other translations where it's translated as headquarters. I mean, headquarters sounds like an office in a building somewhere.
Right.
Well, nobody knows where their office is.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
You know, but in Marsden, we're talking about the very abiding place of this force. I mean, that's, you know, it's on some other metaphysical level. And he says it remains for the whole people an unknown mystery. And I'm inclined to think that includes even the Jewish people. Even the Jewish people don't know exactly where this force comes from.
Yeah, well, if he talks about, I would think so too. He's talking about the whole.
But there's some kind of power behind this that is beyond, is not exactly human. This next one, I think, is one point I can make about this that I think is really important, which is that the blood and the oceans of blood and tears. This is the one with the oceans of blood
yeah,
and tears.
Yeah, that's the third line up from the bottom, folks.
Right. So in Marsden, he says, through the press, we've gained the power to influence while remaining ourselves in the shade. Thanks to the press, we've got the gold in our hands, notwithstanding that we've had to gather it out of the oceans of blood and tears. Now, to me, it's clear that what he's saying there is that through their control of the press and their ability to print, you know, strategically manipulated news, they set populations against each other. And it's mm-hmm. clear what happened in the world wars. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing that happened with America after 9/11. We go, all these Americans all pumped up with hate for Islam and Islamic culture. And we go, you know, blow up these countries and kill millions of people. You know, this is part of the thing of blood and tears, oceans of blood and tears. But, you know, clearly what they're saying here is that the blood and tears are Gentile blood and tears. They're not Jewish blood and tears. I mean, he does point out at the end that
we have
had to sacrifice, you know, some of our people to do this. But the oceans of blood and tears are not Jewish. What's that?
He says many of our people. But he says each victim on our side is worth in the sight of God 1,000 on the other side.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we hear him say that all the time. That's Talmudic.
Yeah. So, you know, many of our people. I mean, look at World War I. Okay, how many, you know, the casualty figures? Mm-hmm. You know, the blood and tears of Gentile.
That's right.
I mean, undoubtedly, you know, some Jews were in the wrong place at the wrong time, just like in World War II. But the blood and tears are clearly Gentile blood and tears. Yeah, I mean, the oceans. You know, the Jews always like to talk about how they're this minuscule percentage of the population. Okay, if some of those people get killed, that's not going to create an ocean of blood and tears, right?
Well, and then, you know, they think of it as many of their own people, because if one is worth 1,000 others.
Well, yeah, but it's still
then,
not going to
be. This is, yeah, oh, well, right, in our truth. But, you know, for them, you know, they see just a few as a terrible thing, you know, terrible loss, mm-hmm. few of their people.
But the point of this passage, though, I think, reading Bart Marsden's version, is clear, which is that through the manipulation of the press, through the manipulation of news, they're able to set populations in conflict against each other. And then, of course, they're famous for funding both sides, providing weapons to both sides, providing money to both sides, cashing in from both sides as these Gentiles tear each other to pieces in these needless wars.
Okay, and how does that not come across in Brazel?
Well, let's maybe jump down to Cameron, because I think Cameron is where it's really, really misleading. He says, you know, the press has fallen into our hands. Through it, we have attained influence while remaining in the shadow. But then he says, thanks to it, we have amassed gold, though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so totally different. You're right.
Totally different.
Okay, so what's wrong with Cameron there? He's reading Brassall's English translation, I assume. Now, why does he change it like that?
I don't know.
Well, what does Brassall say?
Brassall says, through it we have attained influence while remaining in the background. Thanks to the press, we have gathered gold in our hands, although we have had to take it from rivers of blood and tears. But
yeah.
It cost us the sacrifice of many of our own people, and every sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of muted or vague in Brassall.
Well, he says the same thing. You know, people could argue. He says the same thing. However, it's not as powerful. It's not as
rivers. There's a big difference between rivers and oceans.
Well, to some people, it might not be, because rivers is a lot of blood too.
Yeah.
But I think that basically what I've seen with Brassall so far is that he's accurate, but he doesn't have the poetic quality.
Well, it's kind of dumbed down. It's like the third grade version.
Okay. Well, now, what about that one about make-believe? I like that one. I think
that's that's another one. So make-believe, the phrase make-believe in Marsden's translation.
Well, here it is.
Comes up several times.
But it's in protocol number one, and it's your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 one down on that page.
Let's see. Yeah, I've got a couple
six
of ones.
One down.
Let's see. How does that start?
6-1 down. The political has nothing in common with the moral.
Oh, there we go. Okay, right.
Yeah.
You're right. Political has nothing in common with the moral. This is Marsden's version. The ruler who is governed by the moral is not a skilled politician and is therefore unstable on his throne. He who wishes to rule must have recourse both to cunning and to make-believe. So that's, now listen to Braesall. Braesall says, politics have nothing in common with morals. That's almost the same, I guess. The ruler guided by morality is not a skilled politician and consequently is not firm on his throne. He who desires to rule must resort to cunning and hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
So hypocrisy is a very crude translation because hypocrisy is not a strategy. I mean, in Marsden's version, that last sentence, he who wishes to rule must have recourse both to cunning and to make-believe. So when we talk about recourse, that's a strategic term. You know, this is what we'll do if we have to, or this is what we'll do if we need to. But in Braesall, it says he desires to rule must resort to cunning. So resorting is something, oh, like I have to do this. I'm being pressured into do it. You know, I don't have any choice. It doesn't sound like strategy. It sounds like something that you're compelled to do. Whereas in Marsden, it's clear that he's talking about a deliberate strategy. And then when you look at what the strategies are, it's cunning and make-believe. So make-believe is deception. It's like deliberate deception.
When I was reading this, because that's in Protocol 1, I was really impressed by that make-believe, because I was thinking probably in terms of their control over entertainment and movies and TV and all that stuff and all the stuff we see that isn't right, and maybe thinking about 9/11 and
9/11,
you know, all these things.
That's
right. Because make-believe really fits what the Jews do. And I think about Elie Wiesel and all these Holocaust survivors and their stories, making things up. And then they believe it.
Yeah, the whole gas chamber story from beginning to end is an example.
After they make it up, they convince themselves that it really happened, and because all the others repeat it. So they believe it. So that is big, big, big with them. And how Marsden got that, I don't know what the original word was, in the language it was written in, but hypocrisy is not right.
Hypocrisy is not a strategy.
No, it's not. It doesn't even have the same feeling.
It's a character defect hypocrisy. Or something, but it's not a strategy.
Well, hypocrisy is not make-believe either.
No, it's not. It's
something
not.
Totally different. I mean, everybody is guilty of hypocrisy to some degree or another, you know. There's nobody that's not hypocritical at times, but we don't make things up and, you know, try to pass them off as the truth like they do. Well, that's a good
in major ways. Well, you know, look at Hollywood. Hollywood is in a whole industry of make-believe.
That's right.
And it's the vehicle through which we're all indoctrinated from a young age. I have a friend who teaches middle school in Colorado, and she was telling me the other day that the topic of genocide came up in her class last week. And right away, all the kids in the class, the first thing they talked about was, you know, Nazis and World War II and Hitler and all of that. That's genocide in their minds. And these kids are like seventh graders.
I know.
And they've already been thoroughly indoctrinated. And then on another occasion, she was reading me from the high school history textbook. And right there in the textbook is 9/11 was Al-Qaeda, you know, attacking America. So these false stories, you know, get embedded through our children's textbooks. I mean, they're in our children's textbooks, and they become embedded in the understanding of reality that our kids, you know, grow up with.
All right, right. We got another message from Hasso, and he says that if you remove the name of Solomon, there's no name there at all, which is what I think. There is no name. So Vincent added Solomon.
Huh.
You know, because I didn't remember any name. I remember them talking about it.
But I have seen, you know, criticisms of the protocols where they bring up Solomon. claims that the protocols originated in the days of Solomon. And I've read that elsewhere.
So other people picked that up. And
maybe
he doesn't have that translation that you have from. Oh no, that's the one that Vincent supposedly used. Oh yeah, and he doesn't have that. He's probably looking at Marsden or.
I don't
definitely
know. Not in Marsden.
He just has Vincent's French critique, and then he translated it into English. Let's go back to where you were. I think that. I was going to say that, where's this page?
If we jump up a couple, there's an interesting one.
All right.
This one from Protocol 9, it's,
that would be third one, right?
De facto, the one starts de facto?
Oh, yeah. Right.
So Marsden says, de facto, we have already wiped out every kind of rule except our own. And then in Bracewell, it says, de facto, we've already destroyed all governments except our own. And then Cameron switched that around to say, de facto, we have already eliminated every government except our own. So both Bracewell and Cameron, you just scratch your head and go, what governments? I mean, what do they mean?
Well, and that's where, mentioned
that. We still have our own government. It's like the Jews don't, you know.
Yeah.
But in Marsden, the meaning is very different. He says, we wiped out every kind of rule except our own. So when he's talking about rule, he's talking about, you know, their kind of rule.
Yeah, you mentioned that on the international
Which is unseen
too.
Manipulation.
Right. This is what Having Scott objected to when we read it on the International Jew.
Well, testifiably.
And that came
from Cameron.
It
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was trying to defend it somehow. So that's real interesting. I can tell him that.
Yeah, now. Bracewell, this is another example of an awkward translation where somebody doesn't know the language very well. So he translated whatever the term was in Russian into government, which is not correct.
And maybe he thought also that made more sense. You know,
it probably made more sense to him, but it's
right,
not true to
exactly.
The original meaning. So the fact that Marsden was there, you know, during the Bolshevik Revolution, and he saw how it happened. You know, is really important. He probably also saw what, you know, going on with Britain, you know, and the invasion of the British government and the same kind of rule, you know, like the Balfour Declaration and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So their kind of rule, you know, is unseen manipulation, you know, through rewards and punishments, you know, bribes and payoffs, sexual favors, intimidation, blackmail, financial pressure, assassination, all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's carried beyond government. You know, into banking and media and academia and all this, you know, every level of society. So that's their kind of rule.
So he says, de facto, we've already wiped out the other people's rule of all
every
this.
Kind of rule except our own. So there may be the appearance of government, but they're ruling from behind the scenes.
Very good. Very good.
And that's
how
the point.
Do we explain our government, which you talked about in the first hour? I mean,
what's that?
How we explain, our government, which you talked about in the first hour, it's really just the way you put it. And, you know, when you really look at what our government is doing and has been doing, it's just there's no explanation for it whatsoever.
Yeah.
That makes any sense except this.
Right. Right. Mm. So that's clear in Marsden that it's you just scratch your head over the Bracewell version and think it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what's another good one here? Oh, then the next one I think is also really good. From Protocol 2,
mm-hmm.
Marsden says, the intellectuals of the Goyim will puff themselves up with their knowledges and without any logical verification of them will put into effect all the information available from science which our agentur specialists have cunningly pieced together for the purpose of educating their minds in the direction we want. Okay, so the key phrase is there, intellectuals of the Goyim will puff themselves up with their knowledge and without any logical verification. Okay, then we read Bracewell, and he says, intelligent Goys will boast of their knowledge, and verifying it logically, they will put into practice all scientific information compiled by our agents for the purpose of educating their minds in the direction we require. So in Bracewell's version, it sounds like we're talking about something legitimate, like legitimate science, like they've got scientists, then the Goys will verify it logically and then pretend like they figured it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in Marsden, it's clear that they're talking about false science. So we see this, you know, it's big time in 9/11. You know, like the NIST, mm-hmm. When NIST did their analysis of the destruction of the World Trade Center, you know, with this progressive collapse theory. You know, that was mm-hmm. all verified. I mean, that was, they
right.
puffed themselves up with that without any logical verification. It defies physics. It's just not true.
You know, they put that out right away early on. And, you know,
yeah,
at that time I was wasting tons of time in a discussion group for several years, really. God, what a waste. With a bunch of liberals. And I was, you know, pointing out all this 9/11 stuff all the time. And they just acted like they couldn't see it. And then they'd point to the NIST, this one woman pointed to the NIST thing. And like that made a lot of sense. And, you know, you couldn't get through to these people because they didn't care.
Yeah, she puffed herself up with her knowledge. But without any logical verification.
Okay, yeah.
That's the same thing with the gas chamber story. You know, we supposedly have all these self-combustible corpses.
Yeah.
You know, like at Treblinka or even in the ovens of Auschwitz. You know, they say, well, we put 3 or 4 corpses in at a time. And then they burn faster and with less fuel. You know?
Yeah, right.
Or we just pile up a bunch of corpses at Treblinka and light a match and they all go up in flames. You know, that's ridiculous. You know, corpses
and
are made out
of water.
And then when
people read this from some authoritative source, they don't even think they have to think about it. They just say, well, it said so here, so that's good enough. And they accept it, go on. They don't require themselves to think themselves. Yeah.
Right. So they, you know, they have their agent tour specialists, you know, that work their way into all these institutions of academia and science and government agencies and stuff. And then, you know, the goyim, however you want to refer to everybody else, it just falls for it all and thinks it's all true. You know, it's amazing how that happens. Of course, then there's people on the sideline jumping up and down saying, no, physics. But nobody.
Yeah, but they wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't fall for it if our own authorities would say differently. But
if we had real scientists analyzing the destruction of the World Trade Center, they would say, oh, my God, something
weird.
Well,
we do have some, but nobody
listens. Well, we do have some, but, I mean, they're not, like you're saying, they're not in a position.
Neither the government or the media will acknowledge these people. In fact, they'll even call them names. I mean, the president gets up and defends the Holocaust and calls Holocaust deniers evil or something. He's done that in his speech. So when they do that, you really have to say that there's a government media conspiracy at the very least, and it's always pro-Jewish, so...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it fits the pattern.
You can't take the government out. You can't just say, oh, it's just all the media. This is what some people have been arguing with me, that, well, it's the media, it's the Jewish media that's doing all this, that's behind people believing all this stuff. Well, they believe it because of what the media says, but the government supports them. Well, it's not just the media.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be both.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not just the media. It's the media. Right. It's this convergence of media, academia. I mean, academia is a big piece in it.
Right.
Academia, and then, of course, the government. Mm-hmm. And then the big piece is the control over the publishing of school textbooks.
Yeah, and then, but they're only going to go along with the others. But then, you know, the academia is supported by government money.
Right.
And so, again, it goes back to if they weren't supported by government money, they would be more independent. But the universities have to require the professors to follow the line because they want the money. You know, the professors might not care, but,
but
you know,
if you look at the administrations of the major universities, I mean, they're all populated by, you know.
That's right. That's right. It's the administration.
Like,
it's the people who run the university who are in league with that, and they get the money. And, and that's how this whole system operates. It's not anything like what it should be. Nothing.
Yeah. Then money is behind all of it.
Yeah. And Jews always remind us in the protocols, we have the gold.
Yep.
The first thing we did was get the gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that, of course, goes back to the Rothschilds.
Here's this make-believe again. In Protocol 1 further down, Marsden says, our countersign is force and make-believe. And Brazel says our motto is power and hypocrisy. So
yeah,
whatever that word was, it was used more than once.
Right. No, it comes up three or four times. In every case, Bracewell translates it as hypocrisy.
Yeah, right.
And in every case, the meaning is drained away by this awkward translation. Our motto is power and hypocrisy. I mean, who's ever going to have a motto and have hypocrisy be their motto? I mean, it sounds stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bracewell translation. It just sounds stupid. It sounds dumb. You know, and that's what leads people. That's what I think. That's why people come to the conclusion that it's, you know, it's what they call a clumsy forgery or whatever.
So Marston had a better understanding of what was at stake and so on.
Well, he knew, yeah, he knew what was going on.
And did this Bulgari woman, you know, who had been a revolutionary, I guess, anti-Tsarist, grew up that way, and then kind of changed, but we don't know that much about her. I'm not saying, though, that she was trying to do
it. No, I just think their command of English was very poor.
Yeah, right.
So it creates an impression that the protocols is of the same quality as the translation. I mean, you can only see the protocols through the translation. So if the translation is clumsy and sounds stupid, then you're going to think the same thing. You're going to think, well, the protocols must be the same way.
Well, let me just say this. The Bracewell translation came out in the United States, did it not? In like 1920 around. And that's
right.
That would be the reason why Cameron used it, and Henry Ford, and all that. That's
right. And there were some connections between Bracewell and Henry Ford. I mean, he somehow—I don't know if he brought it to them or what, but they, you know.
Well, he was quite an anti-Semite, I understand, which I'd say in a good way. You know, he understood what was going on, and so he would have probably made contact with Henry Ford, and they would have had some correspondence and so on. So they used the wrong translation.
Yeah, they really did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even from Bracewell's translation, you can see there's something afoot here that should be a concern. But the real essence of it is pretty much lost in most cases.
Yeah, it didn't set them off wrong. I mean, you know, it's not that bad. But it's
it raised alarms, you know, which is good that it should have done that. But it's got within itself, it kind of discredits itself if you look at it closely. Just because of the quality of it, you know.
So, is there more you want to say about the comparisons?
Let's see. Well, this one from 13 is kind of interesting. Marsden says, "Who will ever suspect then that all these people were staged?"
That's fourth up from the bottom, folks. If you're looking for it.
Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Right, fourth up from the bottom. Who will ever suspect then that all these peoples were staged, managed by us, according to a political plan which no one has so much as guessed at in the course of many centuries? You know, I mean, just listen to the language. You know, it's so full of arrogance and contempt and just attitude.
Well, this is where people like Vincent Renoir and Hadding Scott, I'm sure, and others would say there is no evidence that they have been carrying this on for the course of many centuries. And this is one of the things they object to, that this
well,
is...
Well, there's plenty of evidence. It's not within the protocols itself, but it's certainly from a study of history, there's plenty of evidence.
Well, I think so, too. I mean, many centuries... A century is only 100 years, so I can go back quite a few centuries, just what they've been doing in Europe.
Oh, sure, and even farther back than that, right. Mm-hmm. But this concept of being stage-managed, I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. Listen to Bracewell. He says, "Who will then suspect that all these problems were instigated by us, according to a political plan which has not been disclosed by anyone during so many centuries?" I mean, it's just completely different.
It is. You're right.
In terms of its feeling, and it just sounds implausible. You know, instigated versus stage managed. I mean, stage managed, that gets into their whole thing of like blind agents and proxies and all of that. I mean,
oh, yeah, and make believe and fooling us and everything. And that's what,
right. But
that's what rises in people, this terrible feeling of what's been going on, you know, and you recognize the truth of it. Whereas if you're just reading the other, you can probably much more easily put it down and forget about it.
Right. So this idea of people being stage managed. I mean, just look, you know, like the Holocaust story. I mean, some of the most, strident defenders of it are Gentiles.
Yeah.
And these are the people that the protocol refers to as blind agents. They're people that have been convinced of something. No, this is really, really true. Mm-hmm. So then they go around and beat everybody else up about it, and the Gentiles are doing their work for them when that happens.
Well, they've also managed to make a lot of people find it in their best interest. So all these enemies of Germany find, you know, that this helps them, and so they don't care. And then there's the U.S. military and the British military that need to defend themselves against what they did. So everybody has an interest, and they sure don't care about the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. So that's part of this idea. But I think the critical thing in this notion of stage managing is that it's not just talking about Jews here. We're talking about entire populations of Gentiles who have been deceived and fooled and act in their behalf based on false beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't come through in Bracewell at all. It just says, well, these problems were instigated by us.
Well, now I have to do this because he translated Hasso Kastorp, who's pretty good at translation, I guess. I wonder if he's a specialist. He says that from the original Nihilus Russian, he's got two Russian words here, but he can look, you know, he's got to look those up. He says they mean tricks and hypocrisy. So tricks would be fit in with make-believe. And, but again, whoever is saying what these words mean in another language is using
There's an art to translation.
Yes, that's right.
That's a mechanical thing.
I don't want to take up the time, but, you know, I have experience in translation, not because I could do the translating, but I did a lot of German to English translation with Wilhelm Friesemann for this book we were working on. And he did the translating, but he wasn't as good in English in putting it in, you know, in proper English the way it should be. And so I was working with him, and we had to go. Well, I was very particular, so we went over things again and again. I mean, I can't tell you how much editing went on just in that part, trying to understand what the real meaning was and how to say it in English best, you know. And I didn't want to be, I'm very conscientious, and I didn't want to do it wrong. So so I know that sometimes there's just no word, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see if it has something to do with hypocrisy, how he may have felt it also had to do with something else. And so he chose make-believe, which we have found to be the perfect word to use for what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
So when you get that language right in that sense, then you could use the protocols like a lens, you know, brings events into focus, and we can see their true significance. But without that, we really can't. So,
okay, somebody just sent an email, Stu, and said that he likes this program, and he likes you. He thinks you're speaking very well.
Oh, that's nice.
Okay. Compliment. All right.
Yeah, and well, I don't know if you've looked at some of Peter Meyer's material, and one of his arguments about the authenticity of the protocols, he lists all these unusual words that are part of Marsden's translations. You know, words that would not be familiar to the masses. You know, if the protocols were supposedly of this thing that was made up in order to inflame the masses, you know, they'd read this and just, they wouldn't even be able to understand it.
That's right, yeah.
And one of these words that comes up is this word ratiocinations. I mean, I'd never heard that word before. But that comes up in Protocol 10. That's in the very last quote, where he's saying, Marsden says, a scheme of government should come ready-made from one brain because it will never be clinched firmly if it was allowed to be split into fractional parts. And then down the paragraph a little bit, he says, to discuss and make alterations in a labor of this kind by means of numerous votings is to impress upon it the stamp of all ratiocinations and misunderstandings.
Ratiocinations, I think.
Yes.
It's like rational. That. It's like rationalizing it. Ratiocination.
Well, I looked it up, and it has to do. Well, let me just see.
I might have a wrong impression of
it. When I looked it up. Now, ratiocination, according to my desktop dictionary, is to form judgments by a process of logic and reason.
Yeah, rational.
The formal term. It's not negative.
So it's not like rationalizing, which would be negative. Okay.
Right. It's formed.
Okay. Thanks.
And that's lost in Bresol's translation. He says it would reflect the stamp of the misconceptions of everyone who has not penetrated its depth. So there's a, you know, there's a different sense there. That, you know, people have tried, well, it depends on who you're talking about. And that's where the next sentence is important. He says, we want our schemes to be forcible and suitably concocted. Therefore, we ought not to fling the work of genius of our guide to the fangs of the mob or even a select company. So in my reading of that, the select company or the, you know, whoever the people were that were present at this, you know, whatever meeting where this is being read, you know, they're talking about the people that are in the inner circle, you know, the select company. So right. even this select company is not supposed to fling this work of genius. You know, they're not supposed to even submit it to, you know, logical judgments. They're just supposed to take it and act on it.
Oh, okay.
Whereas in Bresol, that says, for this reason, our plans must be strongly and clearly conceived. Consequently, the inspired work of our leader must not be thrown to the mercy of the mob or even of a limited group. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Limited group? What does that mean? Right?
But a select company is better.
But there's no identification of who this limited group is. Whereas in Marsden, at least I get the clear sense, they're talking about those present, you know, this particular select company. They're talking about themselves. And that I think is very powerful because it raises the question of who is this guide that they're talking about, the work of genius of our guide.
Well, what is it?
And whereas in Bresol, he just says, well, our leader. Well, their leader could be anybody. But this guide, I think that's a direct reference to, you know, Jehovah. I mean, they'd have the same guide.
Or something, yeah, their belief system throughout the ages. Yeah, that would be a guide, but that wouldn't be you're right about that. It's not a leader.
Right. It's a guide, which is a very different meaning.
Right.
Then
let's go here from, if you don't mind, in
sure.
the last 15 minutes that we've got here. So you wrote to me, the real significance of the protocols is in the coherence that it brings to our understanding of history and current events. Like a lens, you mentioned that. And then you said, giving us a clear view of the global conspiracy and its perpetrators. Well, now, how do you, you know, let's talk about that a little. How do you see who these people are and when this was, well, you know, in the historical perspective, how do you see it?
Well, I think it translates into Jewish nationalism. I mean, that's one phrase that's used.
But I mean, who do you have any idea of who these people were, or who this speaker might have been, or what he might have, you know, just can you? Because there are various theories, you know, this Ginsburg, and basically Ginsburg or written coming out of the French Freemasonry lodges, or written by Nihilus or Nihilus himself.
I don't really go for any.
And then I read in this Ginsburg page, which is just probably a bunch of baloney, but they just make all this stuff up. But they said that it was, and there was no reference for this, no source. But it was known that it was originally in Hebrew. It was seen in Odessa, people passing it around, written in Hebrew. And so on, is, you know, trying to say that Ginsburg was the author and it was the original was in Hebrew. Have you come across that?
No, but.
I don't put any stock in that at all. Well, they're not after the fact.
I mean, my sense of it is the roots go far deeper. I mean, this is not a document that was created in the 19th century.
I would think that what we have as today's protocol, which mentions,
it's updated. I mean, that's what others say about
it.
Yeah,
it's updated.
It's an
updated
version of an ancient plan.
Well, wouldn't it have been updated all along? I mean, that's
right.
It
had been
so,
updated
but who
all
was
along.
Updating it last? See, we can't answer these questions at all. I mean, there's not even a clue that's worth anything.
Well, it's shrouded in secrecy. obviously, as is the inner councils of Judaism. I mean, it comes out of the inner councils of Judaism.
If it's so shrouded in secrecy, how did it get out of their hands and into the public? You know, that's enough.
Well, the story that you found about the whoever it was wanted to make some money, some extra bucks.
That's in the introduction to the Marsden Morning.
There's a hint at it. Yes, it's not as clear as in
about
the,
that. You know, that's
the other
just, you know, there's no proof for that. That's just part of the story. But
it's not inconceivable to me that someone who knew about this would. It's like the Rosenthal story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, "You'll pay me a bunch of money, and I'll tell you all the secrets."
And then he was killed.
He was killed within months after that happened. And the same thing happened in this story with the protocols.
The Jewish person that got paid off for
providing this document was killed shortly after.
Right. And it says so. But now I'm saying, well, you know, there's so much lying going on, and I don't know where I would have to spend some time. I haven't done it. Looking up to see if I can find records on this man actually being murdered in Egypt. But it sounds believable. And when I first read all that, I thought, this sounds like a credible story. But later I had to say, you know, I have no reason to, you know, I have no real information about it, because then I heard other stories and they don't sound as credible to me as this one. But that doesn't mean that it's actually true. So I'm just making the point here that it's frustrating to me that there's you can't get any information, not even a hint of what it really might be. It sounds like people just making things up about where it came from. And so I can't just say, oh, well, it's shrouded in secrecy and be satisfied. But I still insist that this is a powerful weapon, which has powerful information in it. And it is so close to reality that we cannot ignore that. And therefore, you know, we have to, even if somebody made it up, they sure did a good job. And, but I don't believe that, like you, that it could be made up. It's too, I just don't think anybody could come up with all that.
Yeah, I see it coming more from a metaphysical level or something.
For people who don't believe in that.
I know, but I think that we have to start looking at those levels.
Well, you mean like satanic? Are you talking about satanic?
Well, you know, not exactly necessarily, but you have to look at, you know, some of the history, deep history of this, you know, that the Deuteronomy and that, you know, that set up the Jewish people to kill Jesus. So there's, you know, there's this rebellion against God going on through Judaism. And this, in the protocols, is a fulfillment of the promises in Deuteronomy. It's the method and the technique for delivering on the promises in Deuteronomy. So there's some kind of a deep connection there that I think is
spiritual.
Needs to be considered. Yeah, there's a spiritual connection.
Dark and light spiritual.
What's that?
So it's like a spiritual battle that so many people.
Yeah, there's a spiritual battle going on this planet for sure, and that's been going on for a long time.
I have to think.
This ties into that. What's that?
I just have to think more practically about it. I need to find real life sources and so on for these things. Mm-hmm. But I don't go so far as Vincent or Hadding do and just say, on it. Not at all. But yet I'm not satisfied with it's part of a spiritual battle. So, I think though that if it takes us back into history and looking at what's been going on and so, that's good.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole blood libel thing figures into this somehow, I think. You know, that has to be taken into consideration because that's very occult.
Yeah, we have a few minutes. If you want to say what you can in that time about the blood libel thing, I did also post the link to the book by, the man that wrote that good book.
Right.
Dr. Toa.
Right. He was the son of the chief rabbi in Rome.
Right.
Professor of Jewish Renaissance, medieval history. Uniquely qualified to write this book, being thoroughly familiar with the derivative literature in English, French, German, Italian, as well as the original documentary sources in Latin, medieval, Italian, Hebrew, and Yiddish. This is from the introduction. And if it had been published in Israel in Hebrew, no one would have cared. There are large bodies of literature in Hebrew that Jews do not wish Gentiles to know about. But Dr. Toef's announcement of its publication in Italy in Italian raised a worldwide firestorm of fury. Under unbearable pressure, the book was withdrawn from publication and is not to be reissued. But, you know, fortunately, we have, and here we have another, we're into translations again, but we have an English translation of it.
Mm-hmm. And
this author seems very credible. He's not a raving Gentile anti-Semite or anything. He's thoroughly Jewish.
Okay, but you did say that was the 60-second warning. You did say that at the end or somewhere he says, no, this is in some article, that sometimes these people were accused, sometimes these Jews were accused wrongly. And they were
sometimes, yeah.
They were mistreated.
Well, a child would disappear in the town, in a medieval town. They would immediately think, "Oh, the Jews must have taken him."
Right.
And then the child would show up a couple days later, and they go, "Oops."
And in the meantime, they were actually torturing this person.
In some cases,
I guess they were kind of terrible,
But that shows how freaked out they were and how afraid they were. And people were afraid of the Jews.
Yes.
Because of these things, because not all these stories were false.
I think there's always been fear of the Jews. How do these people get so powerful? This has been interesting. We have to close now, Harlan. And I want to thank you, Harlan Schulte, for being on with me. And I will
thank
ask you to come back so we can talk some more about.
Yeah,
but we didn't
more
get to.
About.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, and have a good day. We'll see you next week.
Bye bye.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.